It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Guy Raz. So one night, about 10 years ago, Gaver Tully had this major realization about his childhood.
I think it all goes back to a pivotal moment, which was a dinner conversation at a corporate Christmas party where I was sitting around a table with some friends from the office, and we had all just been talking about the kinds of adventures we'd had as children.
Gaver had grown up near the beach in Northern California. His mom was a nurse, his dad was a fisherman who also wrote poetry.
They would let us out the back door and we would wander around into the forest, and there was a little cove near our house, so my brother and I used to walk up and down this little trail down to the beach. And as long as we were home by lunch or supper, everything was okay.
And it never really occurred to Gaver how important that stuff was for him until that night at the office Christmas party, talking with his colleagues
about the kinds of adventures we'd had as children. And then I asked them, you know, so how are you making sure that your kids have these kinds of experiences? And the immediate and clear response from most of the table was, oh, well, that's, you know, we barely survived childhood. That's hardly appropriate for children today.
It just seemed totally wrong. The idea that his childhood,
spent tromping around in the woods by ourselves, getting poison oak and bruising our shins, was somehow not important to the development of who we were today.
So Gaver, half joking, just said maybe he should create a summer camp. You know, borrow his friend's kids and give them the childhood they ought to have.
And by the end of the night, I had five or six kids signed up for a summer camp that didn't actually exist other than in my mind.
Okay, start.
Today, that camp does exist. It's just outside San Francisco. It's called Tinkering School, and on a recent day there, you could find six-year-olds making go-karts.
And any nails? I got some.
With a little help.
Two and a half. That's thin, right?
So the question is, what becomes of a kid who gets to play with power tools at that age? And how do the things we do as kids make us who we are?
Put this on the table.
Our show today, growing up, ideas about the making of who we are, what happens in our childhoods, how decisions are made for us by adults, and how all of that shapes the rest of our lives. One thing Gaver says is really important about Tinkering School is that kids are allowed, even encouraged, to do dangerous things, which is why the first building kids enter there is this huge barn. And on one side
is a wall of tools, hand drills, saws of various sorts, you know, rulers, tape measures, levels. And
on the other side of the room
is a wall of materials, which includes lumber, screws of every sort and length, nuts and bolts, pulleys, wheels.
And Gaver says that for a lot of kids, this is the first time they've even been allowed in the same room with all that stuff. And when they get there, some of them, they just stand there, frozen.
Looking left, drills and saws, looking right, nuts and bolts, and realizing anything is possible from this moment on.
Whew. Yeah, like, what's your release form like? It's got to be like 25 pages.
To this day, we've never needed much more than a Band-Aid.
Huh.
But the truth is, in an environment where the children realize, like, this is the opposite of being overprotected, we suddenly see the children take much more responsibility for themselves.
And for the kids who can't make it to Tinkering School, Gaver made some suggestions in his TED Talk.
Welcome to 5 Dangerous Things You Should Let Your Children Do. I don't have children, I borrow my friends' children, so take all this advice with a grain of salt. You know, we live in a world that's subjected to ever more stringent child safety regulations. We put suffocation warnings on all the on every piece of plastic film manufactured in the United States or for sale with an item in the United States. We put warnings on coffee cups to tell us that the contents may be hot. And we seem to think that any item sharper than a golf ball is too sharp for children under the age of 10. So where does this trend stop? As the boundaries of what we determine as the safety zone grow ever smaller, we cut off our children from valuable opportunities to learn how to interact with the world around them. So, despite the provocative title, this presentation is really about safety and about how some simple things that we can do to raise our kids to be creative, confident, and in control of the environment around them. So, thing number one, play with fire.
All right, so you've got fire,
right? Let's call that number one.
Okay, then what?
Number two, own a pocket knife. Number three, throw a spear. Number four, deconstruct an appliance from your house. Number five, drive a car.
All right, cool. That's I love it.
And when we talk about driving a car, let's make clear that it's sit on your parents' lap and steer. But the real goal there is they develop an appreciation and a kind of intuition about what's involved. And sometimes even kind of an understanding when their parents later say, you know, traffic is complicated. I need you guys to quiet down back there. They refer back to that story.
So about some of those other things, like throwing a spear, how could that possibly be a good thing for your kid to do?
Well, the joy we take from hitting, you know, just a tree or something with a rock or making the splash happen in the lake where we mean to, that process builds all those proprioceptive skills that we would love children to have, that sense of where the parts of their body are and trying to get their throw to go further and further. Those are all beautiful developmental stages that are aided by just letting them throw things.
Or how about playing with fire? Well, actually, when kids roast marshmallows or burn sticks,
they're doing perfect science. They have a question, what will happen when I put this in the fire? They observe, and then immediately a follow-on question is asked, and suddenly we see them put an orange peel in the fire. But I think that kind of is the foundation of inquiry, and getting a chance to satisfy that question only builds the impulse to ask more and deeper questions over time.
But I mean, what would happen like if you didn't let your kids do those things? Like you produce like a boring and dull child?
A boring and dull child who is a consumer rather than a creator in their lives, because injuries are going to happen. Let's not let that fear prevent us from letting children have real and meaningful self-directed experiences. So the fact that one child at a school has a pocket knife and another child isn't ready, we immediately denigrate that positive benefit, which is so hard to measure, which is I've empowered my child and he feels like I trust him with this sharp tool. That's a bond between parent and child that's hard to build without actually giving them responsibility for something that has a little bit of danger.
Gaber Tully, his talk is called Five Dangerous Things You Should Let Your Kids Do. Check it out at ted.npr.org. If you think about it, like the one thing that makes us who we are, almost more than anything else, is how we were parented, right?
Oh, yeah.
This is writer Jennifer Senior.
And it's very funny. I don't know when you came of age. I mean, I was parented at a time when the basic theory was get on your bike, ride around the neighborhood, and at 6 o'clock I will bang a gong and you will come back inside.
Jennifer's a mom and the author of a book on what she calls the crisis of modern parenting. And the title, All Joy and No Fun. And it's about the effect that children have on their moms and dads.
There was a pair of people in my book, Angie and Clint, these really relatable, wonderful parents. And I asked each of them what was harder, being a mother and father, or, you know, doing their day job. And when I asked Angie, she said, oh, I find it much more confusing to be at home, whereas I feel very competent in my paid work. And her paid work was she was a psychiatric nurse. She got screamed at. She had to deal with people who were having psychotic breaks. People would bite. They would yell. They would kick. But she felt more competent and in control and confident there than she did at home. And I said, why is that? And she said, because, you know what I'm doing there, and I'm not quite sure of what I'm doing here.
And in the course of writing her book, Jennifer found that a lot of parents are really stressed out about how their kids will turn out. Here's Jennifer Sr. on the TED stage.
Why is it that raising our children is associated with so much anguish and so much confusion? Why is it that we are at sixes and sevens about the one thing human beings have been doing successfully for millennia, long before parenting message boards and peer-reviewed studies came along? Why is it that so many mothers and fathers experience parenthood as a kind of crisis? There has been plenty of scholarship documenting a pretty clear pattern of parental anguish. Parents experience more stress than non-parents. Their marital satisfaction is lower. There have been a number of studies looking at how parents feel when they are spending time with their kids. And the answer often is not so great.
So that's really the word you'd use for parenthood, a crisis?
People experience it as one. I mean, actually, there is in fact no crisis. Our kids are born with lots of privileges that kids everywhere else in the world don't have. But we experience parenthood as a crisis for sure. And I think it's because modern parenthood, the way that we parent now is pretty new. And that's because childhood, as we know it, is really only about 70 years old. And nobody really realizes this, but until fairly recently, kids worked, which is not ethical, but it's how it was. What that meant is that we didn't give a whole lot of thought to parenting.
In a moment, Jennifer Sr. explores the question, can parents produce happy kids? I'm Guy Raz. Stay with us. This is the TED Radio Hour from NPR. It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Guy Raz. And today on the show, we're asking the impossible question. What's harder, growing up or being a parent? We pick up with writer Jennifer Sr., who thinks it was probably easier to raise kids in the old days, and harder in some ways, to be a kid.
Until fairly recently, kids worked. On our farms primarily, but also in factories, mills, mines, kids were considered economic assets. Sometime during the Progressive Era, we recognized kids had rights, we banned child labor, and school became a child's new work. And thank God it did. But that only made a parent's role more confusing in a way. Once kids stopped working, the economics of parenting changed. Kids became, in the words of one brilliant, if totally ruthless, sociologist, economically worthless but emotionally priceless. Rather than them working for us, we began to work for them. Because within only a matter of decades, it became clear if we wanted our kids to succeed, school was not enough. Extracurricular activities are a kid's new work. That's work for us, too, because we are the ones driving them to soccer practice. Massive piles of homework are a kid's new work. But that's also work for us because we have to check it. About 3 years ago, a Texas woman told something to me that totally broke my heart. She said, almost casually, homework is the new dinner.
But I mean, it's not just homework, right, that's stressing parents out.
Well, the world is changing very, 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 very rapidly. We don't have any clue what we're training our kids for. We just know that we have to make them prepared for some future. So we send them to violin lessons, or we teach them how to code because the world is going to be written in HTML, or we teach them another language because the world going forward is going to be multilingual. Oh, and above all, though, we know that we have to shore up their self-esteem.
Yeah.
By the way, no matter what we do, we have to make them feel good. You know,
you're really good at violin.
Yeah.
He's getting better.
Right, exactly. And this is all new. No one used to, you know, in 1850, nobody was freaking out about sleep training. You know, no one was flipping out about whether or not their kid had enough self-esteem and whether they got a soccer trophy. You know, in 1850, this looked really different.
But I mean, another reason we do all these things is because we love our kids. I mean, like you said in your talk, they're priceless to us, more priceless than they were in 1850.
Right. We now assign a very high value to our kids. We have very few of them. I mean, we don't have our kids now until we're 30 years old. So, God, so much is riding on that. I mean, we now look forward to having kids the way that Jane Austen heroines looked forward to marriage. It's this great thing that we are working toward, and it's like the capstone to our lives now, essentially. And so we have all those expectations of parenthood and what kind of happiness it's going to bring us. But we also have this enormous expectation for our children. We want them so much to be happy.
Our kids' happiness is paramount. That is what it means to raise kids in an age when they are economically worthless but emotionally priceless. The one mantra no parent ever questions is, all I want is for my children to be happy. And don't get me wrong, I think happiness is a wonderful goal, but it is a very elusive one. Happiness and self-confidence, teaching children that is not like teaching them how to plow a field. It's not like teaching them how to ride a bike. Happiness and self-confidence can be the byproducts of other things, but they cannot really be goals unto themselves. A child's happiness is a very unfair burden to place on a parent. And happiness is an even more unfair burden to place on a kid.
But that's like natural and normal, right? I mean, we all want our kids to be happy.
It is. It is the one thing we all agree on. I mean, I tie myself up in knots about wanting my kid to be happy. But here's the thing. Some kids aren't going to be happy. It doesn't matter what you do. You know, maybe constitutionally that's just not who they are, right? And so the most you can do is create kind of circumstances that would enable them to feel productive or feeling they were helpful to others. But to actually single-handedly take responsibility for their happiness is super tough.
Do you think that parents now are just, I don't know, I mean, they're trying to do it right. They're trying to improve on everything that came before them.
Totally.
And so is it possible that they're doing it right?
I think everybody gets so balled up thinking that there is a right way. I think it's really anxiety-provoking. And, you know, what is orthodoxy for one generation or even a half generation or even for 3 years is overturned 3 years later. And so when I was out in Stanford reading it for my book, you know, a dean came running up to me afterwards and said, all of our freshmen are showing up under-constructed. That was her word. It was a great word. You know, they've been over-parented. And I thought, oh, God, good Lord. But we all thought we were under-parented. What's medium parented? You know, can we do this medium rare, medium well? I don't know. I mean, it's very, very hard on people, I think, to figure out where this middle ground is.
In our desperate quest to create happy kids, we may be assuming the wrong moral burden. It strikes me as a better goal, and dare I say a more virtuous one, to focus on making productive kids and moral kids, and to simply hope that happiness will come to them by virtue of the good that they do and their accomplishments and the love that they feel from us. That is one response to having no script. Absent having new scripts, we just follow the oldest ones in the book. Decency, a work ethic, love. I think if we all did that, the kids would still be all right, and so would their parents. Possibly, in both cases, even better.
Jennifer Senior, her book is called All Joy and No Fun, The Paradox of Modern Parenthood. Check out her entire TED Talk at TED.com. So what if you didn't grow up with a parent? What if your parent was the state? Hello, is that Lem?
It is, Guy. Hi.
How are you?
I'm good today.
That was the case with poet Lem Sissé. Lem is a nationally renowned poet in the UK. He's now in his mid-40s, but his first 18 years were spent in and out of foster care and state-run children's homes. And for most of his adult life, he's tried to make sense of his childhood through a series of films and poetry. And his story began in 1967, when his mother left Ethiopia to study in England.
She was one of the first women of Ethiopia to go to an international university.
And at the time, she was pregnant.
She's at that very potent age of 21. And the world is just about to open up for her.
And without knowing it,
she's come into a storm. The college sent her 200 miles away to this building full of vulnerable pregnant women.
Lem tells the story of what happened to those women, including his mom, from the TED stage.
In the 1960s, if you were pregnant and you were single, you were seen as a threat to the community. You were separated from your family by the state and placed into mother and baby homes. You were appointed a social worker. It was the primary purpose of the social worker, the aim, to get the woman at her most vulnerable time in her entire life to sign the adoption papers. So anyway, she comes here, 1967. It's her plan to have me fostered for a short period of time while she studies. But the social worker, he had a different agenda. He found the foster parents and he said to them, treat this as an adoption. He's yours forever. His name is Norman.
That social worker, who named Lem after himself, had no intention of letting Lem's mom ever have him back. And so Lem grew up with a white family in the north of England, and he was the only black kid in the entire town. But to him, those were his parents, and everything seemed pretty normal until he was about 11 years old.
And I was on the cusp of sort of adolescence, so I was starting to take biscuits from the tin without, without asking. I was starting to stay out a little bit late, et cetera, et cetera. Now, in their religiosity, in their naivety, my mum and dad, which I believe them to be forever, as they said they were, my mum and dad conceived that that I had the devil inside of me. I should say this here, because this is how they engineered my leaving. They sat me at a table, my foster mum, and she said to me, you don't love us, do you? At 11 years old, they've had three other children. And I said, yeah, of course I do, because you do. My foster mother asked me to go away to think about love and what it is and to read the scriptures and to come back tomorrow and give my most honest and truthful answer. So this was an opportunity. If they were asking me whether I love them or not, then I mustn't love them, which led me to the miracle of thought that I thought they wanted me to get to. I will ask God for forgiveness and his light will shine through me to them. How fantastic. This was an opportunity. The theology was perfect, the timing unquestionable, and the answer as honest as a sinner could get. I mustn't love you, I said to them. But I will ask God for forgiveness. Because you don't love us, Norman, clearly you've chosen your path. 24 hours later, my social worker is waiting for me in the car as I say goodbye to my parents. On the way to the children's home, I started to ask myself, what's happened to me? It's not that I'd had the rug pulled from beneath me as much as the entire floor had been taken away.
Okay, so they ask you this strange question, but basically implying that you don't love them. You're expected to answer that, and you just misunderstood what they wanted you to say, even though it probably wasn't accurate, right? Because you probably did love them.
Oh, my God. I love them like any boy loves his parents.
Yeah.
There was nothing more beautiful than putting my arms around I call her my foster mother now, but, she was my mum, about around her waist. And, I was betrayed. But, Guy, I'll tell you, I didn't know at the time At the time, I was just concerned with living. Children are so incredibly strong and can live through the most terrible, terrible things, can smile after such incredible pain, because their physical body, their physical memory says, you cannot deal with this now. But slowly, as I got to 16 and 17, I realized I have nobody. This is everything I make turns to dust. And that was my entrance into adult life. And that's when the real effect of my childhood hit me.
When he turned 18, Lem aged out of the care system, and he joined a group of writers in Manchester. By the time he turned 21, he tracked down his birth mother, and he finally had a chance to meet her. He didn't know it at the time, but to her, he looked just like his birth father.
So when I met my birth mother for the first time, she wasn't looking at me. She was looking at him. And the moment I met her, I realized that this wasn't my story. This was her story. And everything changed. Everything changed. What could I ask somebody whose story I didn't know?
And how about now? I mean, do you have any kind of relationship with her?
She lives in New York, and she lives on Roosevelt Island and works at the UN, yeah, and has all her adult life. And we have a cordial Manhattan coffee drinking. Mm-hmm. It's nice weather today. Your brothers and sisters are fine. Conversation.
If you just sort of put this aside and you never talked about this, like, let's say you just decided that you were never going to mention this and your past was just going to be a black hole that you never confronted or dealt with.
Yes. We are our story. Family is a group of people building story for each other and then building another family and taking that story on. So whether I articulate it outside of myself here to you or whether I decide, no, I'm never, ever going to talk about it, that still is the making of us. The making of who we are. We are simply the story, the truth of it. You know, I forgave my foster parents only 2 weeks ago.
Wow.
I got my foster mother and I called her and I said, I'd like to meet up with you and I need to tell you that you're okay. I need to forgive you. And it's the first time I'd met her in years.
Wow.
And I forgave her from the bottom of my heart.
I mean, this is a journey that you've been on for more than 20 years, right? And
yeah.
And it's just recently you have made this decision to do that. What changed?
You know, we carry our stories and they become so airtight that we can suffocate ourselves with them. And I slowly realized that I was starting to suffocate myself with this wondrous story of this suffering boy who'd solved all of the problems, who'd found his family, who'd traveled the world, who'd blah, 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 blah. And I realized that I was carrying a story which was so watertight that I was suffocating myself. And I realized that I was doing that because I was blaming people. If I can't forgive the person who has done what seemed to be the worst thing that anybody could do to anybody, if I can't forgive them, then what does that say about me, about my growth and my development?
So, for people who don't know you, I mean, you have accomplished so much. I mean, documentaries for the BBC, you were like the official poet of the 2012 Olympics in London. I mean, you have made it. You've had a life which a very small percentage of humanity ever experiences. And I wonder if a big part of your process as an adult is kind of has been because you knew that in order to function, you had to kind of work through the damage that happened in the first 18 years of your life.
In many ways, I think I'm possibly lucky to have been allowed to experience and learn from my experiences. But I do to this day think that success is being able to look in the mirror and know that I'm all right on that day. I don't believe I've made it. I believe that I'm making it. I believe that I've found my past so that I can live in the present. It's the most important thing to me. And the books and the plays and the touring and the gigs and the speeches and the cash, it all pales into insignificance when compared with knowing that I didn't do anything wrong. And I'm okay now.
Lem Sisse is a poet in Britain. You can check out his full talk at ted.npr.org. More ideas about growing up in just a moment. I'm Guy Raz, and this is the TED Radio Hour from NPR. It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Guy Raz. On today's show, growing up, stories and ideas about the making of who we are. And for writer Andrew Solomon, finding out who he is has been at the heart of everything he does.
I'm the author of a number of books, most recently Far From the Tree, Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity. The topic of all my work is resilience and hope, and I think the world is full of both of them.
Here's Andrew on the TED stage.
When I was in second grade, Bobby Finkel had a birthday party and invited everyone in our class but me. My mother assumed there'd been some sort of error, and she called Mrs. Finkel, who said that Bobby didn't like me and didn't want me at his party. And that day, my mom took me to the zoo and out for a hot fudge sundae. When I was in seventh grade, one of the kids on my school bus nicknamed me Percy as a shorthand for my demeanor. And sometimes he and his cohort would chant that provocation the entire school bus ride, 45 minutes up, 45 minutes back. Percy, 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 Percy. And I graduated high school without ever going to the cafeteria, where I would have sat with the girls and been laughed at for doing so, or sat with the boys and been laughed at for being a boy who should be sitting with the girls. I survived that childhood through a mix of avoidance and endurance. What I didn't know then and do know now is that avoidance and endurance can be the entryway to forging meaning. After you've forged meaning, you need to incorporate that meaning into a new identity. You need to take the traumas and make them part of who you've come to be, and you need to fold the worst events of your life into a narrative of triumph, evincing a better self in response to things that hurt.
What do you think it is about experiencing something traumatic or something that just sort of sears itself into your memory early in life that then sort of shapes who you become?
I think those early experiences are very powerful and can be very determinative, that you end up developing an image of yourself, an image of what your strengths are, an image of your weaknesses, an image of the ways in which the world is going to limit you. And I think for me, I had a sense very early on, not that I was gay, because when I was a little child, I didn't even know what gay was, but that I was different from other children. And I think I struggled with that sense of what to do about how different I was starting at a very early age.
Some of our struggles are things we're born to. Our gender, our sexuality, our race, our disability. And some are things that happen to us. Being a political prisoner, being a rape victim, being a Katrina survivor. Identity involves entering a community to draw strength from that community and to give strength there too. Forge meaning, build identity. That became my mantra. Forging meaning is about changing yourself. Building identity is about changing the world. All of us with stigmatized identities face this question daily. How much to accommodate society by constraining ourselves, and how much to break the limits of what constitutes a valid life. Forging meaning and building identity does not make what was wrong right. It only makes what was wrong precious.
I mean, how did you come to a place where you thought about things, you know, this way?
That was a long and slow process, but I think that it was unfolding at some level over an extended period of time. And I think I was always interested in this idea that if you were stuck with experiences you didn't want, there were things you could do with them and things that you could make out of them. But the point at which that emerged into my consciousness was sort of when I was in my 30s. I mean, when I was a little kid, I hadn't yet come to that feeling. And even when I was an adolescent and kept thinking, how can I take these painful experiences I've had and make something of them, I hadn't yet formulated that that was what I was doing. The language for it came much later on.
In my own adolescence, I went to extreme lengths to try to be straight. I enrolled myself in something called sexual surrogacy therapy, in which people I was encouraged to call doctors prescribed what I was encouraged to call exercises with women I was encouraged to call surrogates, who were not exactly prostitutes, but who were also not exactly anything else. My particular favorite was a blonde woman from the Deep South who eventually admitted to me that she was really a necrophiliac and had taken this job after she got in trouble down at the morgue. These experiences eventually allowed me to have some happy physical relationships with women, for which I'm grateful. But I was at war with myself, and I dug terrible wounds into my own psyche. We don't seek the painful experiences that hew our identities, but we seek our identities in the wake of painful experiences. We cannot bear a pointless torment, but we can endure great pain if we believe that it's purposeful. Ease makes less of an impression on us than struggle. We could have been ourselves without our delights, but not without the misfortunes that drive our search for meaning. Therefore, I take pleasure in infirmities, St. Paul wrote in 2 Corinthians, for when I am weak, then I am strong.
Hearing this story, hearing it now in the context of where we are today, it's hard to imagine, but like that was what you knew, right? I mean, because you understood that what you were was not right. What did your parents think about that? I mean, how did they feel about it?
Well, my parents certainly never knew that I was going into sexual surrogacy therapy. That was something that I had found in the back pages of a magazine and that I did secretly. And if you had told me at the time that 30 years later I would be standing up on a stage and announcing it to the larger TED audience, I would have thought you were insane. So they didn't know about that. I think they did know at some stage that I was gay, but I didn't tell them for a long time. But I think when it came to the idea of my actually being gay, that was sort of a bridge too far for my family. And in some way, it was a bridge too far for myself.
Do you think that part of your parents' difficulty with that whole period in your life had to do with maybe the idea that they couldn't, like there was no way for them to protect you from the pain, the arrows, or all the things that were going to come your way?
My parents saw, I think accurately, that the way I was a way that was not necessarily accepted by the larger society, and that the way I was going to cause me quite considerable pain. And they wanted to protect me from that experience of pain because they wanted to give me a happy life and, insofar as they could, an easy life. And that made a lot of sense. Now, they also wanted to protect themselves. And their self-image didn't include having a gay child, and my being a gay child or my being different in any of the ways I was different had an effect on their identity. Ultimately, I think the identity of parents and the identity of children are incredibly tightly entwined.
It It took identity to rescue me from sadness. The gay rights movement posits a world in which my aberrances are a victory. Identity politics always works on two fronts: to give pride to people who have a given condition or characteristic, and to cause the outside world to treat such people more gently and more kindly. Those are two totally separate enterprises, but progress in each sphere reverberates in the other. Identity itself should be not a smug label or a gold medal, but a revolution. In 2007, 6 years after we met, my partner and I decided to get married. Marriage soon led us to children, and that meant new meanings and new identities, ours and theirs. I want my children to be happy, and I love them most achingly when they are sad. As a gay father, I can teach them to own what is wrong in their lives. But I believe that if I succeed in sheltering them from adversity, I will have failed as a parent.
Do you ever, like, experience anxiety? Like, I don't know, just worried that, you know, your kids might one day experience the kind of pain that you did?
I experience anxiety all the time. I mean, I was anxious in the car on the way down to do this radio interview. I'm sort of given to anxiety. But I do worry particularly all the time about how to protect my children from some of the kinds of difficulty that I went through. It's the problem of parenting that I think we all know how we would be good parents to ourselves, and we have to learn how to be good parents to the children we have. So my children probably won't go through the exact same difficulties that I went through. They're different people, and it's a different time. And what I have to be awake to is not how to protect them from the exact pain I had, which is easy, but how to protect them from the exact pain that they're going to have, which is much harder to figure out. And I feel like that's where the anxiety comes in.
How has your own upbringing, the decisions that your parents made about the way they raised you, and maybe the mistakes they made, sort of changed or informed the way you do it?
You know, I think the most fundamental thing is to deal with the struggle between what you change in your children and what you accept in your children. I think all parenting involves doing both. Some things obviously need to be changed, and some things obviously need to be celebrated, and a great deal falls in a foggy middle territory where it's very difficult to know whether to change it or to celebrate it. And as I find myself struggling with that, I recognize that it was a struggle that my own parents went through as well.
Yeah. I'm constantly worried about whether I'm doing it wrong. You know, just the other day, my 5-year-old was really upset about going to camp, day camp. He just didn't want to go. And I just thought to myself, should I just let him stay home? But then, like, my mother's voice is in my head, who would always say to me, get in the car, you're going to camp, where it's like, where I understand why she made me go.
It rings so unbelievably true to me, both as the experience I have with my child and as the experience I had as a child. And that balance of pushing them and embracing them is very difficult. And I often think of the work of a British psychoanalyst named Rosika Parker, who talked about having to steer between the Scylla of intrusiveness and the Charybdis of neglect. And I think that's often the issue. How much do you want to sort of hold them back and hug them and say it's okay, which is the protective part of parenting, and how much do you want to say you have to go into the world and do things, which is the other part of parenting. And Parker says that we all, in fact, experience ambivalence toward our children, and that as a society, we have somehow glamorized the part that's holding on, and we have stigmatized the part that's pushing away, but that good parenting requires that you do both. And what you're constantly doing is negotiating the relationship between them, and that the ambivalences of parenthood are often the engine of determining how you balance the holding on and the pushing away.
I sometimes wonder whether I could have found such fulfillment in marriage and children if they'd come more readily, if I'd been straight in my youth or were young now, in either of which cases this might be easier. Perhaps I could. Perhaps all the complex imagining I've done could have been applied to other topics. But if seeking meaning matters more than finding meaning, the question is not whether I'd be happier for having been bullied, but whether assigning meaning to those experiences has made me a better father. I tend to find the ecstasy hidden in ordinary joys because I did not expect those joys to be ordinary to me. In October, it was my 50th birthday, and my family organized a party for me. And in the middle of it, my son said to my husband that he wanted to make a speech. And John said, "George, you can't make a speech. You're four." Only Grandpa and Uncle David and I are going to make speeches tonight. But George insisted and insisted, and finally John took him up to the microphone, and George said very loudly, "Ladies and gentlemen, may I have your attention, please?" And everyone turned around, startled. And George said, "I'm glad it's Daddy's birthday. I'm glad we all get cake. And Daddy, if you were little, I'd be your friend." I thought that I was indebted even to Bobby Finkel, because all those earlier experiences were what had propelled me to this moment, and I was finally unconditionally grateful for a life I'd once have done anything to change.
I love this moment. I can't imagine, like, all the emotions you must have experienced at that, when that happened.
It was an unbelievably lovely moment, and I really do kind of think whenever I'm feeling negative about experiences that I'm having, I do think over and over again about that moment, and I think, okay, whatever else is happening, whatever else is going wrong, this child whom I love so much also loves me and sees me in some profound way. I get choked up even talking about it, even talking about it now and without having sort of voted it.
Hearing you talk about it.
It was such a joy to me, and in that moment with George, I just sort of thought, this is what it's all about. The only question it leaves me with is, where do we go from here?
Writer Andrew Solomon. You can see both of his TED Talks at ted.npr.org.
It's great for me to remember, as I put away my toys, that mothers were all little girls one time, and fathers were all little boys. My daddy seems so big right now, he must have grown a lot.
Hey, thanks for listening to our show this week about growing up. If you missed any of it, or you want to hear more, or you want to find out more about who was on it, you can visit ted.npr.org. You can also find many, many more TED Talks at ted.com, and you can download this program through iTunes or through the NPR smartphone app. Our program was produced by Jeff Rogers, Brent Bachman, Megan Kane, Neva Grant, and Sanaz Meshkinpour, with help from Daniel Shukin, Portia Robertson-Migas, and Eric Newsom. Our intern is Alyssa Eads. A special shout-out this week to Josh Rothaus from the Tinkering School. Thanks also to our partners at TED, Chris Anderson, June Cohen, Darren Triff, and Janet Lee. I'm Guy Raz. You've been listening to Ideas Worth Spreading right here on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Girls one time, and fathers were all little boys.